This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Our guest, Elliot Ackerman, dedicates his debut novel, Green on Blue, to, quote, Ali and Big Cheese, who were my friends. Ackerman was a special operations officer in the U.S. Marine Corps who served five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. He told NPR that he started writing the book shortly after his last tour in Afghanistan and was inspired by the Afghan soldiers he had gotten to know as an advisor. This story is told by a young Afghan soldier named Aziz, whose brother is seriously hurt in a bombing. They had both been orphaned by the war. Aziz joins up with a militia supported by the Americans to ensure that his brother is cared for. He finds himself having to make tough choices about honor and vengeance in order to survive. Elliot Ackerman received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for valor, and he received the Purple Heart for leading a platoon in Fallujah in 2004. He worked as a White House fellow. He lives with his family in Istanbul. He has been writing about the Syrian war, and he joins us on Radio Times. Elliot Ackerman, a great pleasure. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So who are Ali and Big Cheese?
Ali and Big Cheese were two Afghan soldiers that I served alongside, and we became close friends. But the book is, as much as it's dedicated to them specifically, I mean, it's also dedicated to many of the other Afghans that I was with over there. And, you know, we did the things that fighting men have always done together. You know, we fought alongside one another, we bled together, we mourned friends together. But when the war was over, for me, I knew these weren't a bunch of guys that I could, you know, go get quarter beers with at the local VFW or keep up with on Facebook. You know, they were trapped in Afghanistan's elliptical civil war. And so knowing that I'd never see them again, the novel is very much an effort to render their world and the war as they saw it as really a last act of friendship.
Do you know where they are today? Do you know anything about them?
The handful that I was able to keep in touch with after I left service, I've since lost contact with. Most of them were fighting in pretty remote parts of either southeastern or southwestern Afghanistan.
And the story is told from the perspective of this young Afghan soldier, Aziz. Tell us a little bit about him, and then I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of the book. How did you conceive of him?
Sure. Well, you know, the book is very much as much as it's Aziz's story, it's also a rendering of the Afghan war in miniature, or that was my ambition with the book, is to sort of show many of these paradigms that I'd seen play out sort of valley to valley, district to district, province to province. But, as you mentioned, Aziz is the novel opens and he is a very young man, and his family is killed, and his older brother Ali begins caring for him, but Ali is horrifically wounded in a bombing, and now Aziz has to take care of his older brother, and the way he does that is by volunteering in this militia. And the deal he basically strikes is that his wages in the militia will, in effect, pay for his brother to stay in the hospital. So as he goes to fight with this idea that he'll be able to support his brother, but also to get revenge on the militants who hurt his brother, he kind of gets sucked deeper and deeper into this increasingly complex war that in many respects is being fought, as he comes to realize the war is being fought for every reason but the ending of the war.
Well, I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your novel.
Sure. So the novel opens, "Many would call me a dishonest man, but I've always kept faith with myself. There is an honesty in that, I think. I am Ali's brother. We are from a village that no longer exists, and our family was not large or prosperous. The war that came after the Russians, but before the Americans, killed our parents. Of them I have only dim memories. There is my father's Kalashnikov, hidden in a woodpile by the door. Him cleaning it, working oiled rags on its parts, and the smell of gunmetal, and feeling safe. There is my mother's secret, the one she shared with me. Once a month she'd count out my father's earnings from fighting in the mountains or farming. She'd send me and Ali from our village, Sperkai, to the large bazaar in Orgun, a two-day walk. The Orgun bazaar sold everything, fine cooking oils and spices, candles to light our home, and fabrics to repair our clothes. My mother always entrusted me with a special purchase. Before we left, she would press an extra coin in my hand, one she'd stolen from my father. Among the crowded stalls of the bazaar, I would slip away from my brother's watchful eye and buy her a pack of cigarettes, a vice forbidden to a woman. When we'd returned home, I would place the pack in her hiding spot, the birchwood cradle where she'd rocked Ali and me as infants. Our mud-walled house was small, two thatch-roofed rooms with a courtyard between them. The cradle was kept in the room I shared with Ali. My mother would never get rid of the cradle. It was the one thing that was truly hers. At night, after we'd returned from the bazaar, she'd sneak into our room, her small, sandaled feet gliding across the carpets that lined the dirt floor. Her hand would cup a candle, its smothered light casting shadows on her young face, aging her. Her eyes, one brown and the other green, a miracle or defect of birth, shifted about the room. Carefully, she would lean over the cradle, as she'd done before taking us to nurse. She would run her fingers between the blankets that once swaddled my brother and me, and, finding the pack I'd left her, she'd step into the courtyard, and I'd fall back asleep to the faint smell of her tobacco just past my door. This secret made me feel close to my mother. In the years since, I've wondered why she entrusted me with it. At times, I've thought it was because I was her favorite. But this isn't why. The truth is, she recognized in me her own ability to deceive.
And that's our guest, Elliot Ackerman, reading from the very beginning of his new novel. In fact, it's his debut book. It's a novel called Green on Blue. I really just love the way the book begins. And reading that for the first time, I just said to myself, we know nothing about these people. I mean, I think you spent time with them. You got to know them. But as Americans, we know nothing about the Afghan people.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's safe to say. You know, in many respects, you know, the ambition of the novel was to take a green on blue attack. And so the title refers to these insider attacks we've seen in the media. So green is military shorthand for friendly troops. In this case, it refers to Afghans. And blue is shorthand for our own forces. So a green on blue attack is when an Afghan soldier basically turns on his advisor and kills him. So the idea behind the book was to, and the story was to try to take one of these attacks and really peel it all the way back through its various layers of motivations and rationale, so that by the time the reader, you know, and I hope this isn't too much of a spoiler, is witnessing the green on blue attack in this novel, you know, they might not agree with the attack, but they at least can see all of the incremental decisions that led to this. And, you know, I believe that, you know, literature, you know, the novel, you know, it's basically, it's, you know, writing a novel is a very intimate experience, but reading one is also a very intimate experience. And I think through all art, we're trying to transfer emotion. And so if the reader can sort of feel those emotions and understand Aziz's story, you know, my hope is that a bridge will have been built. And I think in building that bridge, for me, it was a way to honor my Afghan friends.
And I think for, and this, of course, goes back to, you know, September 11th and the U.S. invasion of that country. But for many Americans, even if they think about Afghanistan today, for this country, it was, in a sense, to avenge 9/11, to capture Osama bin Laden, to topple the Taliban government. I mean, very sort of black and white. But as you write, for the Afghan people, an entirely different experience. This is a multi-segmented war that they've been involved in.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I mean, the war in Afghanistan has been going on for 35 years, since or 36, I guess, since the Russians invaded in 1979. You know, one of the things when you're in Afghanistan, you can really get a sense for the scope of that conflict and how long it's been going on. You know, when you think the life expectancy in Afghanistan in the rural parts of the country is late 50s, early 60s. So if you think about that, that means that somebody who is right now coming to the end of their life in Afghanistan would have been around, you know, 18, 19 years old when the Soviets invaded. So in 10 years, many of those people will have died off, and you will basically have an entire generation, an entire society that has no adult memory of peace in that country. Mm. And when that happens in a society, bringing that country out of war basically becomes a sheer act of imagination. And what happens when no one can remember peace? And there's a character in the book, an old Mujahideen fighter who Aziz eventually goes to live with. And at one point in the novel, he tells Aziz, he says, the future is in the remembering. And I think that's true.
You were an advisor when you were in Afghanistan. An advisor on what? What could you advise on?
Well, I was a combat advisor. So basically, I worked with small groups of Americans. A team of us would embed with much larger groups of Afghans. So the largest group I ever advised was a 700-man commando battalion. Mm-hmm. And, we were basically their combat advisor. So as they planned operations, as they went out, we were there side by side with them, helping them ensure that everything went off well, and then also bringing in some resources like aircraft and medical evacuation that, only we Americans had. But again, as much as it might seem at face value, we had very little in common with these Afghans. We as American, Marines and fighting men, most of us had served in Iraq as well. We'd really been defined by these conflicts in much the same way the Afghan soldiers we were fighting alongside had been defined by these conflicts. And if you take that one step further, it's this idea that our adversary had also been defined by these conflicts. The whole time we were over there, we were engaged in this shadow dance with our adversaries, be it the Taliban, the Haqqani network, or even in Iraq, al-Qaeda in Iraq. And so when the wars are over and you're sitting there back at home, you realize in some respects you have more in common with your adversary who's been similarly so defined than you might with, your countrymen who never had that shared experience.
We're almost up on a break here, but that's what war does. I mean, sort of no matter which side you're on, that's what it does, forge those kinds of intense and perhaps intimate relationships or even friendships.
Yeah, I think so. The poet Yeats has got some verse that he put down in the First World War. It's from a poem called An Irish Airman Foresees His Death. And it opens, "I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere amongst the clouds above. Those that I fight, I do not hate. Those that I guard, I do not love. Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds, but a lonely impulse of delight drove me to this tumult in the clouds." So that poem's always meant a lot to me, because this idea of, first of all, what's it that drives people to fight? It's sort of that tumult in the clouds, which is the combat, and that defines you.
Let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Elliot Ackerman, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, spent 5 tours of duty fighting in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And he's written a novel. It's called Green on Blue. It's his debut novel. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Elliot Ackerman. He's served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. In fact, fought in the Battle of Fallujah back in 2004. He's written a novel about an Afghan soldier named Aziz. He's in the middle of this multi-sided war in Afghanistan, trying to help his injured brother, the novel titled Green on Blue. Aziz also is I guess he's Pashtun.
Yeah, that's right.
And he is in many ways driven by or in response to something called Badal, which is vengeance, something called Nang, which is honor. These are sort of codes that I guess he and others live by. Help us understand, what does Badal refer to? What does that mean?
Well, Badal, Nang, Malmastia, these are sort of the tenets of a code called Pashtun Wali, which is very, very important to Afghanistan's ethnically Pashtun population. And Pashtun Wali directly translates in English to the way of the Pashtuns. Mm. And you know, if you get to know Afghans who are Pashtun, you know, they'll tell you, you know, this is so fundamental to their identity. They'll say, you know, we've only been Muslim for 700 years, but we've been Pashtun forever. It is the most central part of their identity. So when Aziz gets sort of wrapped up into the conflict, and particularly when his brother is very grievously wounded, he has this sense, this ethical code that's been distilled in him of Pashtunwali, and one of the tenets, Badal, refers to vengeance, and he is, as Ali's brother, is obligated to take vengeance for him in order to restore his nong, Ali's nong, which is this idea of personal honor. So Pashtunwali really becomes something that drives Aziz throughout the narrative, but it's, you know, it's also, it's a framework that he's operating under, and we all have these frameworks. Pashtunwali might seem very, very foreign to us as Americans, but you know, we have many of the same incentive structures placed, you know, in our society. They just appear a little bit more invisible to us because we're so used to them.
Interesting. And there is an American referred to as Mr. Jack. Who is Mr. Jack?
Well, Mr. Jack is the only American character in the novel. He's not a central character in the book. He is basically the Afghan militia, which is called the Special Lashkar. He's basically their interlocutor. He's the American who's helping finance them, who is basically running intelligence operations. You know, Aziz never really knows, is this guy working for Army Special Forces or the CIA? You know, who is he working for? It's not something Aziz would know, and so in the novel it's not something that's gotten into. But he is basically someone who you know, who is keeping the Special Lashkar funded. And as the book kind of goes on, we see the incentive structure that Mr. Jack is operating under, and what his goals are for the part of Afghanistan where Aziz is fighting.
There are a couple of scenes, one in particular I'm thinking of, where there are attacks. They're in a kind of a convoy and get attacked. And just the kind of vigilance you have to have, the kind of chaos, not knowing where the shooting is coming from. Was that particularly hard for you to write, or was that something that you could write because of your own experience in war?
It was something that I had experience with. So, you know, in crafting those scenes, you know, I was able to reach back into my past and draw out kind of what some of those feelings and emotions were. You know, I mean, this novel obviously is not particularly autobiographical, as it's, you know, this is the story of an Afghan boy, and I'm obviously not a young Afghan soldier. But I think, you know, frequently how combat is portrayed in Hollywood and on television is not necessarily accurate. The realities of combat are, it's far more chaotic, and most of the fighting I've been in, I think the biggest thing we were trying to do is just figure out who was shooting at us from where. And I imagine on the other side it was the exact same. It's, you know, it's just a lot of chaos and fear.
And why a novel? I mean, a number of Marine soldiers have come back from our current wars, and some have written fiction and some have written nonfiction. Why was fiction important for you?
Well, I believe people remember story, that if you want to touch someone emotionally, you need to touch them with a story. I grew up around fiction. My mother was a novelist. I always knew I wanted to write. I studied history and literature in university. But why am I drawn to fiction? It's because I think stories last and stories matter, and that's how people are touched. You know, they remember a story. And I think, you know, memoir and sort of denser nonfiction, you know, obviously is important, and frequently with events, you know, it's sort of the front line. It's the first thing that sort of captures what's going on. But, you know, fiction lasts, novels last. You know, I probably couldn't tell you a single nonfiction account from that was published about 100 years ago, but I could tick off a bunch of novels for
Indeed. Was this a hard book for you to write?
I think all books are hard to write. I'm still looking for that easy one.
Yeah, no, I get it. But just, you know, this is told in the voice of a young Afghan man, clearly somebody that you're not.
Sure. Well, you know, whenever you're writing, whether it be short story, novel, you know, there's a lot of groping in the dark that goes on, and you sort of have to suspend disbelief. You have to trust that the story is going to reveal itself to you. You know, in early drafts of Green on Blue, it's all told in the first person, in the voice of Aziz. In early drafts, actually, the framework was that there was a framework in place where Aziz was actually, the novel opened and he was telling his story to an American character who actually doesn't even make it into the book, who I removed. And it was sort of this Conradian kind of Heart of Darkness construct, where in that book, you know, the character Marlowe is telling the story of going up river in the Congo to find Kurtz. And it was Aziz telling his story to this American intelligence officer. And it was a story about what happened to him. And I had put that frame in place early on, because I, to be honest, I didn't feel comfortable occupying Aziz's voice. I sort of needed this crutch. But I had to ask myself, if the point of this novel is to allow Aziz to tell his story, then why am I afraid to allow Aziz to speak directly to the reader? You know, and after a lot of sort of soul searching, and I decided to remove that American character, and it was somewhat frightening for me to do so, because that was really me saying, there's nothing I can hide behind now. This book will succeed or fail based solely on the merits of Aziz's voice.
As you said, your mother is a novelist. Did she have any advice for you, or are you better off just figuring this out all on your own?
I think any book, you know, the author is always going to just figure it out on their own. But it's nice to have a framework from which to operate.
You joined the Marine Corps, and you were about 18 years old, right?
I went into ROTC when I went to college. So I joined ROTC when I was 18, and then I was commissioned a second lieutenant in 2003 when I was 23 years old.
Why'd you
went on active duty.
Why'd you want to join?
You know, I wanted to have a job, or whether I was good at my job or bad at my job mattered. And it certainly mattered in the Marines. It mattered in terms of lives. And, you know, I also felt like a fortunate son of this country. I came from a great family, had a lot of opportunities. I was able to go to a good university. And, you know, I felt like I wanted to give something back. And I felt like I could do that as an officer in the Marines. And frankly, a last point, I was also that kid who really just sort of never stopped playing with his G.I. Joes.
So I
was always fascinated by the military and wanted to join.
And you served five tours of duty, whether it was either in Iraq or Afghanistan. What kept bringing you back?
Well, you know, unlike wars of the past, you know, these ones haven't really ended.
No.
So everyone I know who served and has since left, you know, we all sort of had to make our separate peace. I mean, it wasn't like the Second World War where the last battle was fought and we all came home. And, you know, when you're... You know, in the all-volunteer military, you know, these are, you know, you're serving with your friends. And so it becomes very difficult to kind of look at your friends as you come home off one deployment and say, hey, guys, I'm not going to make it for the next one. You know, you keep going back because your friends are there. But, you know, eventually it just, you know, it's time to leave. But that's probably one of the most difficult decisions I've ever had to make in my life. And one of the most difficult conversations I ever had to have was telling certain friends that, you know, that the war was over for me.
How did you explain that to them?
You know, person to person, it depended. I think, you know, it was just the, you know, I mean, they were very understanding groups, the ones that were going to keep on. But, you know, it was tough to see days pass on the calendar when I knew their deployment dates were, and to be sitting at home knowing they were going over and I'd made the choice to stay behind.
It's so interesting that you put it that way, that the war was over for you. As you said, you know, not these wars, but previous wars. Wars were over when the wars were over, and now these wars seem to be wars without end. But it was over for you. You felt what? You had done what you could do?
Yeah, I felt like there were other things that I wanted to do in my life. You know, I was 31 years old when I came back from my last deployment. I'm 34 years old now. You know, I wanted to write. It wasn't the only thing I wanted to do, although I had, you know, been very meaningful for me while I was doing that work. And so it was a decision that I had to make. And I had a young family at the time too. Mm-hmm. And I had to decide what I wanted the rest of my life to look like. And I decided that I didn't want the rest of my life to involve me, you know, going in and out of war zones every year.
Let me just reintroduce you quickly. That's Elliot Ackerman, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And he did serve in the U.S. Marines 8 years. He was in Iraq and Afghanistan, served five tours of duty. And now he's a novelist. It's a new novel called Green on Blue. And we've been talking a bit about the novel and talking now a bit about his experiences in war. And you know, this is something that for those of us that haven't fought, we can have these intellectual discussions about, you know, here we are, the Iraq war that sort of has morphed into what's going on in the Middle East. Afghanistan seems to continue as it has in the past. And for us, it's more an intellectual discussion or conversation, even if we even think about it. But for people like you who have fought in these wars, what does that mean when you're done with the war, but the war is not over?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's a society, you know, if you look at these wars, every war has a construct, you know, so from the national mobilization of the Second World War to the draft of the Vietnam War to the all-volunteer military and wars financed largely through deficit spending of, you know, what we would call the Afghan-Iraq wars that kind of keep going on and on. And, you know, I understand the reason for that construct, but it makes it very easy to go to war. You know, so right now we're sort of having this, as you mentioned, sort of very intellectual debate of, you know, should the U.S. be doing something more active on the ground in Iraq now with ISIS? But it's, you know, it is. It's sort of an abstraction. And I think we've structured it as such, as it's an abstraction, because the people who are going to these wars become an increasingly more self-selected part of our society. And so I think what it means is, you know, you wind up with an enormous civil military divide. It's something that really exists. And I hope as a country we can start having a conversation as we enter. You know, we talk about Afghanistan having been at war for 35 years. We've been at war for 15 years. That's a pretty long time. You know, so, you know, do we want that civil military divide to exist? What are the implications of structuring our wars this way? And what does it say about us as a society? You know, are we entering a point of moral hazard? Is there a moral hazard to going to war in a way where nobody feels it and we can just disassociate from the loss of war? I don't know, but I think we should be talking about it.
I completely agree with you. How did war change you?
Well, you know, it's tough to say. I mean, I think there is this sort of tendency in the U.S. right now to sort of pathologize the entire war experience. I mean, if sitting here right now, you know, I were to hold up two hands and you were to ask me, you know, on that, those two hands, Elliot, kind of think about the best days of your life, I would say at least one full hand and probably part of another would be, you know, I'd hold up and there would be days that I was in combat. Best days of my life. And if you were saying, all right, Elliot, now hold up on those two hands the worst days of your life, I would hold up probably one full hand and a couple fingers on the next hand, and it would be the exact same days. Yeah. And those were the worst days of my life. And so what does it say about me, and what does it say about that experience, that the best days and the worst days are the exact same days? You know, I think there's an intensity of the experience that leads to that. And, you know, and that idea is something I explore in my writing.
Indeed. And you've written both fiction, as we've been talking about, in your novel, and also some journalism, and also some nonfiction as well. I mean, it is a kind of cliche. I don't know if you're comfortable with it, about the intensity of being in war, and obviously the intense friendships that get created, but feeling so fully alive when you're so at risk for death.
Sure. Well, you know, like a lot, you know, a lot gets said about, you know, PTSD and sort of what is PTSD. It's become such a sweeping diagnosis now. And, you know, coming back, you know, there are obviously the folks who have the clear PTSD with sort of, you know, the night sweats, flashbacks, can't sleep. I mean, that's a very real thing. But there's also sort of this other PTSD that I think is, in many ways, sort of far more insidious and is much broader. You know, what I would say about that is, you know, when you, for any person to be happy, I think you have to have a sense of purpose. So for a lot of people, that sense of purpose can be, you know, I work a job, that job puts food on the table, it allows my kids to go to school, they grow up, they grow into a better life, that's purpose, that sense of purpose gives me happiness. Well, for someone who joins the military when they're 19, 20 years old and they go off and they fight a war, they're sitting in a remote place surrounded by a group of people who will probably become, they'll become very close friends with, if not their best friends. And they have a mission, and that mission is often, at least at the tactical level, very tangible. You know, it's a really intense sense of purpose. Like if purpose were a drug, I would say that is like the crystal meth of purpose. It doesn't come any more pure and clear than that in war. And so you do that through your 20s. Maybe you go back a handful of times, but, you know, you can only do it for so long, and then you have to come home. And so when you come home as a veteran, in many respects, that purpose is done. And to find your happiness, you have to repurpose yourself. You have to find a new sense of purpose. And I think for many folks who've had those intense experiences early on, they look at the various purposes out there for them, you know, jobs, relationships, other things, and nothing seems to measure up to the intensity of the work they did in the military, maybe the relationships they had with those other vets. And so if before they'd been, you know, sort of freebasing that crystal meth of purpose, they look around and all they see is Coors Light. And they realize, you know, the rest of my life is going to be sitting on my front porch drinking Coors Light. Mm. And there is an associated depression with that. And, you know, I think that repurposing when you come home from war is something that a lot of vets struggle with. And it's, you know, it's not because their experience has been, you know, because they've had some experience that needs to be pathologized. It's just this natural, you know, you've had a very, you as a young man had a very intense sense of purpose, and now you've come home and you need to find another sense of purpose. And sometimes that can be really hard.
I mean, it sounds like, have you found that sense of purpose? You live in Istanbul, you have a family, you write. Is that giving you the purpose that you've been looking for?
Yeah, it absolutely has. I write. I mean, that gives me a real sense of purpose. But obviously, you know, I can empathize with the scenario that I just explained. Right. You know, I think it's very difficult for anyone. And, you know, and again, like finding your purpose and finding your bliss, I don't think that's something only a vet can relate to. I think there's probably a lot of people listening who never set foot in the military who know what it feels like to be a little bit rudderless and to be struggling to find a sense of purpose.
Absolutely. Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And again, Elliot Ackerman is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's written his debut novel. It's called Green on Blue. He received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for Valor, the Purple Heart. He was leading a platoon in Fallujah in 2004, 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, spent 8 years in the U.S. Marine Corps. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Always interested in hearing from vets and soldiers and Marines when we talk about war. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Elliot Ackerman about war. We're talking about writing. You had a piece, a fascinating piece. In fact, it was about a year ago in the Daily Beast about a conversation that you had with a jihadi, a guy named Abu Hassar. And you met him at a, I don't know, some kind of a lunch place and sat down and had a conversation. He obviously on the other side of the war in Iraq. One of the things that you said to him is being in the Marines, most of our missions involve walking around on patrol, waiting to get blown up by you and your friends. We were almost always on the defense. He says back to you, yes, fighting you, we knew this. It was your nature, but it wasn't ours. Jihadists are as keen for death as Americans are for life. In my first year fighting, many of the men I smuggled across the border never returned. These were educated and good men. I circled that and underlined that because I wonder if that's sort of what we're dealing with today.
Sure. I mean, that piece was basically a lunch between myself and this fellow named Abu Hassar, who had once fought for Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And the two of us met in a Çakale refugee camp, which is on the Turkish-Syrian border, about 500 meters in on the Turkish side. And, you know, he was still an Islamist, you know, Abu Hassar. I mean, he believed in that, he believed in that strand of Islam, and in that ideology. So, yeah, I think certainly, you know, Abu Hassar, those are the people who comprise the ranks of, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, now ISIS. He at the time was affiliated with a group called Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front, But that is the strain of Islamism that I think we in the West have been struggling against for the last decade plus.
He also asked you a question that you said you had never been asked before. He says, "When were you the most scared in Iraq?" What did you say back to him?
Well, in the piece, I recall, you know, a handful of scenarios that I could have said, you know, time the platoon I was in got surrounded in a building in Fallujah. But what I actually told him was, you know, the thing I was the most frightened of, and this is true, is I was the most frightened of getting lost.
Yeah.
You know, I was a Marine lieutenant. I was always an officer. And, you know, you would go out on these long, long patrols and you would be navigating for, you know, hundreds of troops. And, you know, it's pretty humiliating to get lost, to have everybody say, you know, stop the convoy. The lieutenant doesn't know where he's going. We're lost. So I was always petrified of getting lost. And I obviously, you know, in the book or in the piece, talk about how, you know, to this day, I'm sitting here, you know, I've got my phone next to me. I've probably got about 4 or 5 different, you know, Google Maps, iPhone Maps. I've got lots of maps on my phone. So,
so you don't get lost?
To this day, I don't like it. I don't like getting lost. I'm like a very typical male. I hate getting lost. I don't like asking for directions.
Well, especially if you're leading a platoon in the middle of a war in a place that you don't know particularly well.
Right. And it's easy to get lost out there.
You live in Istanbul now. Is that in part to be close to what's happening in the Middle East today?
Well, you know, I'm a novelist, and I am, you know, I'm interested in story, and I like to go to the places where I think the story is the most compelling. You know, so you know, like Faulkner has this quote I've always loved, where he says the only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you know, if you go to the places where sort of great sweeping events are occurring, you can find really amazing amazing stories. And you know, the lunch with Abu Hassar was an amazing story. To be just more frank, I'm working on my next novel, which is set on the Turkish-Syrian border.
Oh,
so I've been there about a year and a half working on that, and then also doing you know, writing essays and reportage for a handful of news organizations.
I mean, I've read some of the stories that you've reported for some of these news organizations, and just to sort of ask you a couple of, you know, current event types questions. One is, of course, the frankly frightening spread of ISIS, able to conquer so much of the Middle East and destabilize the region. From your perspective, do you see these roots going back to the U.S. invasion of Iraq and Al-Qaeda?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, ISIS is Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and we've, for whatever reason, have seemed to, in popular consciousness, bifurcated the two as though they're two totally separate organizations. But ISIS is a direct evolution. It comes directly evolved from Al-Qaeda in Iraq. I mean, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the self-proclaimed caliph and leader of ISIS, was the last head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So, you know, these are all linked together, and the American experience serves as a unifying thread through much of it.
I hear struggles in this country. You know, here we are. The United States is on the side of Iran when it comes to the conflict on Iraq. It's on the opposite side of Iran when it comes to Yemen. And again, we're kind of used to being on, you know, on one side or the other. But it seems that more and more these conflicts, and in part your book is about this, are these multi-sided conflicts where you can have shifting loyalties and be fighting with the people that you're then making alliances with.
Certainly. And I think that, you know, I have, you know, I think I consume the news as acutely as anyone. I have yet to hear any person in a position of leadership in the United States explain to me or explain succinctly to anyone, to the public, the grand strategy behind what we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. Why, for instance, we are against the Houthi militias in Yemen and are fighting alongside the Saudis in Yemen against the Iranians. But how come we are supporting the Shia militias in Iraq and then negotiating a nuclear deal with the Iranians? I don't necessarily understand how this fits into some grand strategy. And frequently, you know, something I explore in the novel is that, you know, wars have economies behind them. And by economies, I don't necessarily mean financial economies exclusively, although that's part of it, but they take on a life of their own. You know, there are people in the story, in the book, and in real life, who are elevated by war. You know, leaders of militias. These are people who were of little renown before the war shows up, but then they go on to lead these units. So if they've been elevated by war, how are they incented to end the war?
Yes, which is a very provocative question. Do you think there is a grand strategy? I mean, one that would actually deal with the complexity of these problems?
Well, I think that we elect leaders and that their job is to come up with those strategies. And as of now, I have not seen that strategy. It seems to be missing in the public discourse. I think that most Americans, if they are paying attention, are, like me, a little bit befuddled by exactly why we're behaving and who we're supporting and the reasons why we're supporting them. And or if they're not paying attention, which I think, you know, many, many people aren't paying attention because they have their lives to live and they're not incented to pay attention. You know, they don't have children who are registering with the draft and they're not being asked to pay more taxes. You know, they don't really have to pay attention. And that kind of goes back to, you know, what we were talking about before, the potential of running into moral hazard, where the U.S. is intervening all around the world and the American people really are a little bit asleep behind the wheel. Because whether we like it or not, these things are being done in our names.
What does the U.S. look like from Istanbul, where you live?
The American experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, if you're in the Middle East, has completely informed our identity abroad. So being an American, let me put you this way. People want to talk to you about the war in Iraq.
They do.
When you tell them that you're American.
What do they want to know?
Mm-hmm. They don't want to know. They want to tell you what they think
they
about
the war
in Iraq.
And what do they tell you then?
That it was, you know, that it was a mistake, that America has acted very ham-handed in the region. But the thing is, too, there is still a lot of goodwill to Americans that exists on the individual level. I think it's an important distinction to make. You know, I have a friend who went to Tahrir Square during the Egyptian uprising and was covering it. And at one point, basically came at odds with some folks with the Muslim Brotherhood. And the point he made to them, and that was very clear, was that the individuals in the Muslim Brotherhood said, "We have nothing against Americans. We have something against your government." And I think around the world, there's that sense that the people and the government are not necessarily always the same thing.
Even though we elect them.
And that we elect them.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Elliot Ackerman, our guest on Radio Times. And again, he's got a new book. It's a novel. It's his debut book, I should say, called Green on Blue. He's also been writing about some of the conflicts in the Middle East for The New Republic, The Atlantic, The New York Times, and picking his brain on a whole host of things in this hour of Radio Times. I do want to talk about Bo Bergdahl. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. You had a piece in the New Republic. This, again, goes back almost a year, June 2014. I was a Marine in Afghanistan. Bo Bergdahl haunted us all. You call him in this piece a Jonah. What does that mean?
Well, it's funny, you know, a lot of these places I write for, they never take my headlines. The proverbial clickbait.
Yes.
I actually ran the story was the original title. The one I liked was Bergdahl and the Whale.
Which speaks perfectly to what you wrote about. But
right.
What's a Jonah mean?
So a Jonah, and this gets to why it's Bergdahl and the Whale. You know, a Jonah in nautical traditions is a member of the crew who brings bad luck. And so when talking about Bo Bergdahl, I served in Paktika province during the time Bo Bergdahl was missing. I wasn't in the units that he was with, but he was just sort of this figure who kind of loomed large, you know, that if something bad happened, if there was an ambush or, there was, you know, an Afghan walked off the post or anything, there was frequently you would sort of hear this refrain of, you know, it's because Bergdahl is doing this or Bergdahl did that, or if Bergdahl hadn't left. He just sort of had become, and particularly amongst some of the army troops that I would bump into who are more closely affiliated with him, he had become this Jonah, this sort of talisman of bad luck amongst many of these soldiers who were fighting there. And that's sort of what I discuss in the piece. I think it's less that he haunted us but I think more that was a very frustrating time to be in a very difficult part of the country where the war was quite bloody. And Bergdahl and the way that he went missing, he became the center of many people's discontent.
And do you think he's responsible for the deaths of soldiers looking for him?
I think it's very difficult. I think it's very difficult in a war to say why someone necessarily gets killed, why someone survives. I think it's, this goes back to fighting when I fought in Fallujah, you know, you would see, I saw Marines get shot and killed. And is it because they made a mistake? No, it's luck. I mean, there's a lot of lead and rock and debris flying around, and if you know you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you'll have bad luck and something will happen to you. So to necessarily say that Bo Bergdahl caused these soldiers to be killed, I mean, I can understand how one would come to that conclusion, saying, well, we were on this mission, the point of this mission was to try to find Bo Bergdahl, and then a soldier got killed, so Bergdahl is in effect responsible for his death. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you can make the argument that, well, he would have been on a similar mission in the exact same village, the reason would have been different, that same soldier would have died, or a different soldier would have died. I think it's very difficult to draw direct correlations between those things. But I definitely understand why those soldiers are frustrated and bear a lot of anger towards Bo Bergdahl. And I think that the way his homecoming was orchestrated, where he was sort of trotted out as though he was sort of one of these John McCain or Stockdale POWs who'd served heroically, I think was an incredibly poor taste by the administration.
Do you have any sympathy for him?
On an individual level? Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly. He seems to be a troubled man, so...
You were in Fallujah, and this was, what, 2004? So this was early on in the war, I guess shortly after those four Americans were burned and hung from the bridge in Fallujah. I mean, it sounded like an absolute frightening place.
It was a frightening place, yeah. It was, it had, at that point in 2004, had really become sort of the, it had become the center of activity in for Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and at least in Al-Anbar province, everything bad that was coming out in that province was coming out of Fallujah.
I mean, could anything have prepared you for the kind of fighting that you saw there?
I was very well prepared. You know, I had spent, since I was 18, I had wanted to go into the Marines. I was 24 when I fought that battle. So I'd spent the last 6 years of my life preparing to be a Marine officer, an infantry officer. So I actually felt very, very well prepared. You know, it sort of wasn't a matter of preparation per se. I think it was more a matter of, you know, you would be going through the motions. You know, I mean, that battle was basically seven very intense days of fighting. And the battle lasted a month, but there were 7 days where it was back-to-back very intense. And I remember going through those days, you know, getting up after a couple hours sleep, putting my boots on, and having no sense that I would be thinking about that day, the day that was to come for the rest of my life. What I didn't understand was how important those days would become in sort of just forming my identity, how large they would loom in my life in the future.
In the five tours that you had in Iraq and Afghanistan, were you ever wounded or hurt?
I was wounded in the.
I guess that's
how
you got your Purple Heart,
that's
right?
Yeah, I got Purple Heart, but I mean, there were plenty of guys who got it a lot worse than I did.
Yeah. As you said, you're working on a second novel. I won't ask you anything about what it's about. I know that. But how is it going?
It's going well. I'll tell you a little bit. I mean, it is set on the Turkish-Syrian border, and it is a love story. So that's what the book is about. I've been working on it for about the last year and a half now. Be finishing up soon.
Well, Elliot Ackerman, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Thank you for writing the novel, and obviously thanks for your service as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Elliot Ackerman's novel called Green on Blue. And again, he served five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, was in the U.S. Marine Corps for 8 years, and lives now in Istanbul with his family. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program, how to find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, and sign up for the newsletter. Lots of good stuff there as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.